So, welcome to the monastery. It's our first experiment for a longer retreat. And thank you, Marian, for making the invitation. I had this in mind, actually, because I had heard that several people could not afford to do the retreats at Elizabeth Briere and so on. Well, that's not right. The Dhamma shouldn't be about money, so... We've got this beautiful hall, thanks to Ajahn Kuslo and Venerable Atulo and others. So, might as well make use of it. It's going to be a kind of experiment because half of us will be resident here for the retreat, and half are commuting. So we'll see. We'll see how that works. What I would ask, and you, I think you already know that, what I would ask for those who are coming and going, if you made the morning session after breakfast and the morning session after lunch, minimum, because that's when, that I think you get two good chunks of time. We get 3.5 hours in the morning, 4 hours in the afternoon. Those long chunks of time are really good for developing awareness, a sustained attention, sustained awareness. So those chunks of time are very important, very helpful. And then also be giving instruction at this time and at 1:30. And hopefully within 4 days, then I have a kind of... I seem to build up a set of practices that are kind of progressive, make sense. So if you could come to all that, then I'm sure you'll get enlightened. Or close to it. Priyani and Anoma have kindly offered to make dana for all of us, which is rather marvelous. So that's good. And it is a monastery is really based on generosity and morality and an aspiration to enlightenment. So all those factors are quite wonderful human aspirations if you think about it. The aspiration to live a good ethical life and not harm other beings and not harm yourself. Wonderful, wonderful. And then the aspiration to share and be generous and compassionate. These are wonderful human things. And then, of course, the aspiration to realize the profound peace of the heart, the profound openness of the mind. That's also very, very noble. Trouble is sometimes our minds are not that noble. We get grumpy and it's too much salt in the curry, or all kinds of things happen to the mind. So there is the ideal that we live by, that we aspire to, and then there's the reality of consciousness, the reality of our own minds and our own conditioning and so on. So in terms of, as you know, in terms of the moral precepts, we try to live in a monastery by the 8 precepts. So those who are our resident here took the 8 precepts last night. So they're both moral precepts: not harming, not lying, in the case of monastery celibate life, stealing, not taking drugs which change consciousness. So those are the kind of basic moral structure of the Buddhist lifestyle. I think we all know that. And then the renunciant practices of not seeking entertainment out. So that'll be an interesting one for those of you who are going home. So I suggest when you go home, first thing, do nothing. First thing, go into your room, go into your flat, go into your home, sit down and do nothing. Because usually the impulse is to do something, to get the emails done, to sweep the floor, to feed the cat, and feed the cat. But just to look at the mind, which is compelled to always do things, I think that would be a very... I was just kind of reflecting what would be helpful, for that transition. So just to come into your home and see, how does your home environment affect your mind? Is it one where you feel, great, it's safe for me, it's good, or is it one that compels you to always fix things and do things and so on? And just come to awareness, oh, this environment affects you this way. Neither good nor bad. So you establish mindfulness when you come into your home rather than just be driven by some you know, the habit that you might have. And then from that, do what you need to do. But I would suggest during the retreat, do as little emailing as possible. Do as little, don't pick up any projects. Food-wise, I would suggest you do it like we do at the monastery. So try to establish a food routine where you're just eating three times, maybe. Here we eat twice. And create a kind of a discipline where you can watch maybe the kind of tendency to just graze and nibble. I mean, Susan, your comment was great. It's not in here. And Susan would put it, if I may say, puts a sign on her fridge and says, it's not in here. That is brilliant. So just to know that, like not, you know, not to feel it's wrong to have a pot of yogurt at 12 at midnight, but to know how access to all that affects you, and then to say, well, no. I watch that tendency rather than just follow that tendency. Which is, I think, a very kind of interesting one to practice with. So when you do go home, try not to seek out distractions, and look at the mind which is seeking out distractions, that restlessness of the mind. And I mean, if family allows, if you have, you know, if you have kids or whatever, you know, you have to take care of that first. But just in general, watch how the mind is always going out into the objective world, either through kind of criticism or judgment or through fascination, and just try to bring the mind home all the time. Bring it home, bring it home. Very, very simple. So food, entertainment, do not sleep in a high and luxurious place is the eighth precept. I don't know who's in that, who's on the big bed in the house? Who's in that? Christine, you've got the biggest bed in the house. That was Rocky's bed. He was our kitchen steward. But you're allowed to sleep on it because there's no room on the floor. The whole thing about that precept about sleeping in high luxurious places, it's really about not just annihilating the mind through constant sleep. That's what it's about. So that's the sort of, you know, I think we're all aware of those moral principles and renunciant principles, and just, like, I know some of you are like commuting to Ottawa, it's a long drive. When you get back to home, just see what does driving, how does that affect your mind? You know, it can't be the same as walking through the woods. It's a different effect. And rather than think, I'd like a different effect, it's this effect. Right? The driving affects me in this way. So you're always coming back to awareness rather than just being caught up in the quality of your experience. Walking through the woods and listening to the owls at night and the beautiful, if the stars are out, it's fabulous. It's a fabulous experience, but still an experience. It's still just an experience. I mean, it's helpful. It's helpful. And the experience of maybe a traffic jam on Highway 7, when you're coming out here and you're trying to get here on time, it's a different experience. It's a frustrating experience, right? But awareness knows that, and that's what we're always trying to return to. So if you use all of that, driving in traffic, being at home, or being with family, whatever it is, and just keep coming back, though, this is how this affects me. This situation affects the mind in this way. So the affects come and go, they come and go, but the knowing, you begin to have real stability in awareness, rather than being reactive to the effects that life has on you. And then when you do react strongly, right, when you react strongly, just keep coming back. Whoa, am I reacting strongly? Rather than I shouldn't be reacting strongly. Just keep coming back to that simple simple awakening of the mind. So that's why I use listening. I find listening is a very simple way to return to that kind of consciousness which is present, which knows the way things are, and which can understand the way things are. It's not a technique, it's just a way of coming back to the present moment. So I would ask you, how do you have a consistent way to returning to the present moment? Do you have in your practice, do you have a kind of methodology that you have a lot of confidence in? And that's not intellectual, right? It's not like a whole bunch of ideas. It is a practice, it is a craft, it is something you do. And do you have confidence in that? So personally, I have a lot of confidence in just returning to listening and sustaining that silent mind. And if my mind starts to doubt, maybe I should be doing something else. I say, oh, that's doubt. Listening. Yeah. So do you have confidence in your practice? What do you have confidence in? What are the default mechanisms that you habitually move into? Is it like do you habitually go into analysis? Why am I thinking so much? I wonder maybe it was this, maybe that's why I'm thinking so much, which is more thinking. Or does a mind habitually go into judging? Oh God, there we go, I'm thinking again. I think I have to try harder. You know, my samadhi's down there. It's more thinking. So observe the thinking patterns that you're preoccupied with, and get a feeling for what's the underlying tone of them, what's the mood. So, like if I wake up in the morning and the underlying mood of the mind is critical, then I'll just find that my mind will always just find things to criticize. Oh yeah, that's the critical mind. It feels this way. And if I don't believe in it, it changes. If I believe in it, then I can feel either guilty or believe it. So if I believe it, I give a very ugly talk about, well, how, you know, you should all be different. And that's coming from my critical mind, right? Then I just yell and scream at you, and that's not happy for me or you. But the other way, too, is that I shouldn't have a critical mind. That's also not true. It's just the critical mind. And just to know the mood, how the mood is interpreting this moment, right, the way I relate to you or the way I walk around. Just begin to, oh yeah, that's the way that mind is moving. So you become a listener of your own inner world, not a judge. And then you choose as much as possible to speak from places which are compassionate, kind. And quite often you choose not to speak. this is very skillful. But it's not a rejection of that. You know, that's just conditioning of the mind. It's not a rejection of feeling critical. It's just knowing that, say, that particular mood, pursuing that mood is not profitable. It's not healthy. You know, it's not happy. So if you keep coming, returning to something, and then you have to, I mean, you've all practiced enough that you have your own ways of awakening, but how do you? And is it consistent, and is it like from a sense of confidence? Yeah. Yeah, this works. This really works. It's very helpful. Very helpful. So that the mind isn't always caught up in intellectual doubt. And intellectual doubt is just tricky because it's so believable. You know, but it's just thought. You know, I am confident. Am I confident? It's just a thought, you know. But the listening, oh, this is a feeling of doubt. So that's one thing I perhaps would kind of suggest, that you inquire about your own practice. Do you have confidence in awakening the mind? Do you have confidence in the awake mind? These kinds of things. Does your mind always move into thought and into doubt and so on? So I'll kind of make suggestions about awareness. And the thing about the Buddhist practice, it's quite simple in many ways. It's about awakening and non-grasping. And I think every teacher is trying to figure out a different way to say the same thing. And language is interesting that way, because sometimes, you know, the word mindfulness becomes dead because we've heard it so many times. And then any teacher says, well, so how can I say the same thing in a different way? And it's not to be clever. It's just to refresh the mind, to come back to the basic insight of the awakened mind. That's what I think we're trying to do. At least that's what I'm trying to do. And so I'll just speak from my own, you know, what works for me. And if it doesn't work for you, fine. Right? But the kind of basic principles, hopefully we understand those. So the pattern will be that I'll try to give some instruction at this time, and then we'll sit for 45 minutes or an hour, and then we'll break up the rest of the morning into a walking session and a sitting session. If you like to do a lot of sitting, if your knees are good and your back is good and so on, you're welcome to stay in the shrine room and do sitting practice. But if you do the walking, Try to stay with the posture you've chosen. So if you choose to do the sitting, like an extra hour sitting, stay with that. If you choose to do the walking, stay with the whole walking. Okay? I would ask that. So stay, like if it's a 45-minute session of walking, stay with the walking. If you have to go to loo, fine. If it's a bucketing down rain, of course. But try to develop a kind of discipline of staying with your posture. So there's a kind of container, because it's not very calming to get bored and then leave because of boredom. Say in the walking meditation, you kind of think, well, 20 minutes, I can go have a cup of tea now. And it's not. It's not immoral to have a cup of tea, but quite right in that moment when you feel restless and bored, very important to stay mindful. Because if you stay mindful of that, this is restless and boredom, I don't want to do this, and you stay with that mood and keep walking, that'll settle your mind into the walking, and you start to like the walking more. But if each time in a walking practice you feel, it's not working, you know, this isn't really working for me, I'll go do something else, then each time you do walking meditation, you get to the same point. And that will be a kind of restlessness of the mind. So just knowing states of mind like this isn't working. This is pointless. Nothing happening. Just to know that is very important, because there's nothing supposed to happen. So quite often the mindsets are very gray and kind of ho-hum, ordinary. And if you don't allow that ordinariness to run its course, and you keep seeking the extraordinary with desire, your mind never gets peaceful. So just allow it to feel like, oh, this is pointless. Walk back and forth. And then your mind settles. So those are what we call the moha characteristics of mind, kind of subtle characteristics of mind. So the way I was to kind of trained as a monk is to stay with the posture, not to hurt yourself. You know, like if your body's really hurting, then obviously change it. But try to stay with the posture and use all the mindsets that come up within the sitting, within the walking, to establish mindfulness. Rather than thinking that a session of meditation should always be pretty nice and happy. You know, that won't give you much strength, and you'll probably never get it. But if you see that everything is a chance to awaken to, then you get a lot of strength. And that does take you to peace. If you're functioning from history and memory, and you're trying to get something you had 2 retreats ago, 20 years ago, the white light, bliss, open-hearted enlightenment, this will be a disaster. Because all you'll do is be in the past and never be in the present. You'll always be seeking some kind of experience, and you'll almost get there, but not quite. Because it's only in the present moment that your mind really realizes peace. And that means that quite often you have to be at peace with the unpleasant. If you're willing to do that, patience, endurance, and so on, if you're willing to be with the unpleasant, you'll be amazed at how the unpleasant can take you to peace. But craving never takes you to peace. Craving just takes you to frustration. And that's very hard, right? Effort's very, very hard, because we are so conditioned to attain, to get rid of. And those very hard. So right effort's an important thing to watch. If you have any questions, I think Marion said we could put questions in this bowl. No questions yet. I'll try to answer them. I won't answer questions to the floor, because that becomes too discursive. And I'll try to deal like that. I think that's it for me in terms of just general outline. So Marion has, if there's any questions on household things, Marion can answer those, and any Dhamma questions, I'm happy to answer that. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break, and then let's come back and do some more sitting, okay? A bio break, we call it a bio break.